The John Age Project.
Trust no one. Trust no one. Trust no one.
You found it. You're here. You're headlong down the runaway train that is the Anomic Age. I'm your host, John Age. Thanks for being with us today on the program. We've got a special guest, Dr. Jack Cascio, coming up in just a mere matter of moments. He's going to be getting into his newest book, which will be out soon, Barack Obama's Promised Land. Deplorables need not apply. So we'll get into that and so much more today with our guests. But before we do, check out AnomicAge.com. Share the link, friends, family, loved ones, and enemies. Like all the likes, subscribe to all the subscriptions. iPhone app, Android app. Make sure you select the preferences for notifications. And the best part, PayPal.me/AnomicAge, Patreon.com/AnomicAge as well. If you like the show, if you like the information breakdown segments, the guests, please, I encourage you to become a contributor, sponsor, patron, what have you. All that and so much more can be found at AnomicAge.com. So enough of that. We'll be joined by our guest in just a mere matter of seconds. Stick around. It is my pleasure to welcome Dr. Jack Cascio into the Anomic Age today. Jack is an independent writer, documentary producer, and media consultant. Thank you so much, Jack. There's so much more we could get into with your bio. Author of some tremendous books, Exposing Obama, From Flight 800, Ron Brown, and so much more. But I'm just happy to have you with us today. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on here. I'm really pleased. And, you know, the beauty of being an independent writer today is that the big stories are left on the table. The media choose not to talk about the things that ended in a generation or two ago. They would have been fighting to talk about, at least we think they would. So, you know, when I first got into this, I couldn't believe the scale of stories that were left untold. And it's I've moved into that void. It's a shame that that void exists, but now that it's here, you know, I might as well take advantage of it.
Absolutely. Well, I definitely want to get into Obama and sort of who's pulling the strings in the O'Biden administration.
Right.
But kind of like that Sun Tzu thing, we got to know your enemy. And I really want to get into something I know you know so much about, written so much about it, is just the Obama pedigree, if you will, and sort of how we got into this perfect, imperfect storm that we're in today. Because – you know, like so many of us know, Obama didn't just pop up overnight. I mean, people, the narrative, if you will, would have us all believe that he was just this community organizer, which is just code for a rabble rouser that stirs up trouble, that just rose to fame. And here he is. He's the great Barry Satoru. But there's so much more to his story than that.
Yeah, you're right. And, you know, what's intriguing is that the major media, I'll just call them big media. They're not mainstream in any real sense of the word anymore. Have chosen not to know anything about Barack Obama's past. And, you know, they literally know more about George Washington's first couple of years than they know about Barack Obama's. So if you asked, and I'm going to ask you this question, I don't mean to put you on the spot, but you probably know the answer. Where did Obama spend the first year of his life?
I believe that'd be with Frank Marshall Davis, but I could be mistaken.
No, he spent the first year. This is how tightly held this information is, in Seattle, Washington.
Oh, I didn't know that at all.
And on Capitol Hill. I mean, he occupied Chaz before there was a Chaz, you know, the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone. If I could walk into a major newsroom and say, hey, where did Obama spend the first year of his life? They wouldn't know. But that's a critical detail. On the right, researchers knew this as early as 2008. The mainstream first started acknowledging the truth of it with David Marinus's 2012 biography of Barack Obama. Barack Obama, My Story. And this is Marinus, Pulitzer Prize winner. It took him to 2012 to figure that out. In 2008, this is how bad it is. Marinus writes a 10,000-word article for about Obama's Hawaiian years. And before the election, like in August 2008, when Obama's still a cipher, and he does not even mention the person Obama mentions more than anyone else in his own book, Dreams from My Father, and that is, of course, back to your other comment, Frank Marshall Davis. No mention of him. How can you write a 10,000-word on Obama's Hawaiian years without mentioning the person Obama thought was most important in his own formation? You know, that's not by accident. Well, they didn't want to talk about Marshall Davis, and you know why. He was not only a member of the Communist Party USA, but he was also a pedophile and a pornographer. You know, he's not exactly the kind of person you want grooming, or, and grooming is the word here, our future president.
Wow. Well, the obvious question is, what the heck was he doing in Seattle all this time?
Is the answer. What happens is that, it was an important story to tell. And then I think it deformed a lot of our own thinking about how Obama got to be where he is. But I personally believe he was born in Hawaii. I believe he was born in 1961. I don't believe he was born in August 1961, which is his credited birthday, but I'll talk about that in a minute. But here's what we know now, and the other side concedes, you know, they acknowledge it. The biographers do. The rank and file Democrat has no idea. Is that there never was an Obama family. That Barack Obama Sr. and Ann Dunham, the mom, never spent a night under the same roof. We know now that when, in late August 1961, when Obama would have been just a few weeks old, his mother took him to Seattle, where she was from, not Kansas, she was from Seattle, and she raised him there by herself for the first year of his life while she attended classes at the University of Washington. This has been proved 20 times over. The other side admits it now. What that means, though, is that might not seem like a big deal unless you had identified yourself fully, as he did in 2004 at the convention and again in 2008, both speeches. He starts off, I'm the result of an improbable love between a goat herder from Kenya and a farm girl from Kansas. And they came together and they showed the world that people from different cultures could love together. And that's how I came into the world. And then, unfortunately, when I was two, you know, my father got this call to go to Harvard, blah, blah, blah. David Remnick, another Pulitzer Prize winner, you know, a big Obama lackey, described this as his Obama's signature appeal, this story that he told. He invested tons of energy in that story. It was that which not of his presidential aspiration. And, you know, we remember what that campaign was like. And it was all about that story, the narrative. None of it was true. We know that now that, I mean, they admit that there was no, the most recent Obama series biographer, a guy named David Garrow, another Pulitzer Prize winner. They're all named David, by the way. They're all Pulitzer Prize winners. They're all on the left. Garrow is left enough to think Obama a failure because he was too centrist. That's how far left he is. But he's a truth teller. And he said that, you know, and he says that, if anything, Obama Sr. was a sperm donor in his son's life, nothing more. He acknowledges the whole Seattle story. So, in other words, he based his candidacy on a major lie. And then the question comes then, the next question becomes, and I talk about this in my new book, Barack Obama's Promised Land, The Portables Need Not Apply. How is it that this all happened? Why did they need the lie? We do know this, is that the first serious attempt to unearth Barack Obama's birth certificate came not from a conservative, but came from a Democrat. This guy named Philip Berg, who had been deputy attorney general in the state of Pennsylvania. He was a serious guy, a Hillary supporter. He took Obama and the DNC to court to see Barack Obama's birth certificate. Now, of course, you're not allowed to talk about this anywhere because you're supposed to not believe that none of this, you're supposed to believe that none of this happened. What I found in doing the research for my new book, though, is the law firm that Obama used to fight back Philip Berg's lawsuit. And the name of that firm is Perkins Coie. I don't know if that name rings a bell, but Perkins Coie was the same law firm that produced the Steele dossier. Perkins Coie was the same law firm that brought CrowdStrike in to cleanse or to examine the DNC servers after the alleged breach by the Russians, right? Mm-hmm. Perkins Coie was the go-to high-dollar Democratic deep state law firm. So they didn't just hire, they didn't just fight this Berg suit. They brought in the heavy hitters to fight this suit. And in Washington, heavy hitting is what it's all about. So then the question comes, what was Barack Obama trying to hide? You know, and there were multiple attempts, other suits brought by, you know, different people, a lot of several of them on the right. And they even brought in Attorney General Eric Holder to fight the suits. Why were they spending literally millions of dollars to beat back these lawsuits when all he had to do was produce a birth certificate? And I'd like to get your take, because everyone has an opinion. Mine is an opinion. I would call it an informed opinion, but it's an opinion. Tell me yours, John, and I'll share you mine. Why do you think Barack Obama resisted sharing his birth certificate?
Well, I mean, for me, the obvious answer would just be that he has something to hide, because I think if you and I or anybody else were asked, you know, well, prove you went to high school, well, somewhere we'd dig out a high school diploma. Here it is. You know, I went to blah, blah, blah. And, you know, it's a no-brainer. So if you have nothing to hide, you just pull it out and there it is.
Yeah. So why is he doing this? Well, I think here's my theory. And I go into the book in some detail as to why I think this is true. You know, Occam's razor basically is the simplest explanation, it's the best. But if you go to the original Latin, it says this basically it translates the simplest explanation that accounts for all the relevant variables is the best. Now, in Obama's case, and what I've had to do, I've had to take one for the team. I had to read Barack Obama's newest memoir, A Promised Land, and review it. Basically, it's at the heart of my book. It's very revealing in some odd ways. But I also have read all the mainstream biographies of Barack Obama, you know, including ones about his mother, about his father. These are written by people from the New York Times, Washington Post, et cetera. And there's one detail that they all talk about that no one on our side ever does. And that is that in the summer of 1960, without any really good explanation as to why, Ann Dunham, her father Stanley, and her mother Madeline, the little Dunham family in Seattle, leave everything behind and go to Hawaii. This is in the summer of 1960. Here's what we know about Ann. Her name is really Stanley, and I'm going to call her Ann. She's kind of a wild child. She ran off on this sort of Jack Kerouac-y kind of road trip with some guy. They had to go retrieve her. She has a thing for men of color. She's admitted as much, right? The question is, in 1960, why did young girls get sent away from home, you know, inexplicably, right? Mm-hmm. In my neighborhood, as a kid, there's always like someone was showing up from Wisconsin to live with her aunt, or, you know, and it just happened all the time. Or my next door neighbor, for instance, who got pregnant, she went away someplace for 6 months, came back. We weren't supposed to know there was a baby involved, but there was.
Yeah.
My supposition is that that she was impregnated on the mainland by an African American, and that the family left for Hawaii, A, because it's reasonably close, but B, because it was the one state in the union at that time where you could raise a mixed race child without much stigma. Mm-hmm. Certainly wasn't true back on the mainland. It was rough for children born in 1961, mixed race. And so then they get there, they want to create a, they're not trying to create a fiction so they could elect a future president. They're going to create a fiction so the boy will have a father. And then they find Barack Obama Sr., who is already married, by the way. He's got a wife back in Kenya. He's going to college at the University of Hawaii. He needs to extend his INS, his immigration status. This is all recorded. He goes, he says, hey, listen, I have an American wife. She's Hapa, pregnant. Let me stay longer. And they think he's a wild guy, but they let him stay anyhow. So it works out for everyone. He gets that, his extended stay, he doesn't care about her because he's already married. He's ignoring his wife back in Kenya anyhow. And the baby gets a father. And the father, at that time, curiously, there was higher status for Africans in America than for African Americans. Hmm. So in other words, if you were an African, you were routinely treated better than if you're an African American in many parts of the country. So then they create the myth about him being like the, you know, the ruler of some tribe or prince of this, that, you know, and they elevate his status. They fill his head with stories. I think it's altogether possible that when Obama decided to run for president in 2007, he was still believing the stories they told him when he was a kid. That that this guy was his father, that he left home when he was two to go to Harvard, that, you know, he was some sort of prince. In his new memoir, Promised Land, and you know, about which I frame my own new book, Barack Obama's Promised Land, he says, comes flat out, he says, I didn't meet my father until I was 10 years old, right? I mean, he drops the whole birth story. It's all gone. The whole Obama family's gone. He severed all ties with the Obama family. His Obama relatives back in Africa saying, what happened to us? What are we, chop liver now? You know, he doesn't call us, doesn't talk to us, doesn't invite us anyplace. And for a while there, he was building a lot of his identity around his relationship to these people. He made multiple trips to Kenya. So I think it was when he was running for president. And you know how you do a deep dive on your own candidate to find out where his weaknesses are? I think when they went into his files, they said, hey, Barack, there's a problem here, you know? And then you'd say to yourself, well, why not just come forward and say, you know, fess up? Well, in 2004, he'd already established at the convention his story, right? That's what made him a candidate. And now that story is rendered to be just shown to be a total fraud. His signature appeal is now just a sham. And they could not live with that. And they had to fight that every step of the way.
Wow. There's another aspect that I think connects to all this that I just wanted to get into because I honestly haven't done enough research to determine, okay, this is legit, this is not legit, but
right.
What's the connection, if any, with the grandfather, the Ann Dunham's father,
right.
And CIA? I mean, I've heard that thrown out there a little bit. Oh, there's a government connection where he was sort of, I won't say in on some sort of grand conspiracy, but at the very least in on some sort of government hierarchy, as well as the mom, or the same sort of notions have been floated out about her. And I know, you know, this is sort of a silly side note, but within academia land, it's Ann Dunham. Oh, she's an anthropologist. And that's always touted as some big, oh, she's one of us. Bollocks, I'll say it nicely, but is there any validity to any of that? And what is sort of the backstory on Obama's father a little bit?
Well, here's what we know is that Barack Obama's mentor in Hawaii, of course, was Frank Marshall Davis, who was a literal card-carrying member of the Communist Party USA.
Mm-hmm.
And there's about a 650-page file, FBI file, on Davis. It's been gone through. There is a reference in one of these documents to his friend, Stanley Dunham. Now, I think people have tried to get at, see if there's an FBI file for Dunham. I know one has never surfaced. So I do not know if he was a any kind of Soviet agent or communist sympathizer. We do know, however, that he was tight with Frank Marshall Davis. They drank together a lot. He turned over his grandson's formation as a black man to this Frank Marshall Davis. And they spent a lot of time together, Davis and young Obama, when he was an adolescent. Obama wrote two poems about him, at least. I believe Davis wrote at least one poem about Obama. Personally, I think the relationship was more than just a mentor and mentee. Frank Marshall Davis is an admitted pedophile, basically. At least his fictional character is admitted as a pedophile. I believe that he was, and he's admitted bisexual. I don't doubt for a second that he was instructing Obama in the ways of homosexuality. As to the CIA, I don't think the grandfather, Stanley Dunham, had anything to do with the CIA. He was too low level, too insignificant. The mother is a different story, because she had the perfect cover to be a CIA operative. And that is this globe-trotting, anthropologist, right, who is going to places which at that time were very much hotspots, like Indonesia, which was right in the middle. When they got there, when Obama gets there as a six-year-old, about 1967, I guess, they're in the midst of this whole big civil war between the communists and the Muslims, oddly. On that side, at that time, in fact, the Muslims really, with U.S. backing, did a number on the communists. So it was a pretty brutal place. And her husband at that time, Lolo Sotero, was working for an American oil company. My guess is that he was more, from what I know from Obama's own accounting and others from her biography, Lolo Sotero was more fond of the United States than Ann Dunham, who was your classic, ahead of her time, secular, humanist, anti-American, self-loathing kind of character. And if you look at her, she seems to have eaten her way across the South Pacific. When she gets there, she's kind of young and cute. By the time she leaves, she looks like she should be floating in the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade. I'm just kind of a big lady. I mean, Moomoo's cover a lot of sins, but she had a lot of sin to cover. I don't know that she was a CIA agent. She worked with the Ford Foundation. She worked with all these front organizations. If she were a CIA agent, it was not at a level that I don't like making much difference,
Yeah. Yeah, I find the anthropology connection and kind of like you mentioned, I mean, all that does kind of make sense working with like you said, these front organizations or these NGOs.
Right.
And being a white woman in the middle of all these weird war zones, it doesn't make a heck of a lot of sense for most people.
And what most people don't understand about the CIA is that it was a left-leaning organization from its formation. It's unlike the FBI, which most of whose members are pretty conservative. The CIA was the opposite. That it recruited from the Ivy Leagues. It recruited these kind of people, these internationalists, globalists, CFR types, who were never quite sure what side they were on in the Cold War.
It was basically in the 60s they unveiled that many of the social sciences, anthropology, sociology, psych, were having these sort of CIA connections and putting operatives in the field to try to get intel on, I think it was primarily Central and South America, but they were doing it in the old world too. But
yeah, and what they've done, and it's, I think it's a reasonable assignment, is that the CIA, I've known people who were in this circumstance, like let's say they needed a government license or clearance to, let's say, to operate behind the Iron Curtain during the 60s and 50s, 70s. Mm-hmm. And they would say to him, okay, we're going to give you a license, but you're going to be an industrial engineer. You're there to buy machinery, blah, blah, blah. But we would, in return, we'd like you to keep your eye on what you see and report back to us. That went on a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And that strikes me as a legitimate function of the CIA. Where the CIA doesn't get legitimate is when they're orchestrating coups against the sitting president of the United States or covering up a shooting down of an American airliner by our own Navy. That's where the CIA overreaches. And, I'm sure they've overreached elsewhere.
Yeah.
I just see, I've begun to think that I just wonder how useful they are. I mean, I don't even know. I'm beginning to think that if they, we cut 90% of the people who work for the CIA, we'd be better off.
That's the truth. Yeah, I looked it up to make sure I was right. It's Project Camelot, a counterinsurgency study begun by the U.S. Army in 1964.
Hmm. Yeah.
It interweaves those social sciences, like I was saying. I just thought it was a strange connection there for the Obama pedigree, if you will.
Sure, and Camelot, of course, was the term that Jackie Kennedy sort of threw over the three-year Kennedy presidency after he died. And we didn't call it Camelot at the time. It was called Camelot only after the fact, really to please Jackie, you know. So, and JFK was, you know, for all his virtues, was up to stuff. He would do stuff going on and that even they wouldn't go on today. It was beyond what would go on today, you know.
Yeah.
Especially involving Cuba and such things, you know.
Well, one aspect of this you touched on that I haven't heard a heck of a lot spoken of is the Frank Marshall Davis being a bisexual, being a pedophile, and possibly doing something with Obama.
Yeah, well, you know, the Obama's poem called Pop, which he wrote, which he was published when he was a either a freshman or a sophomore at Occidental in L.A., when he came to college in the mainland. Some I've talked to, you know, some psychologists who read it as they're saying this is about a man-boy love relationship, you know. Mm-hmm. And what was interesting is when the poem, when Obama first surfaced, and I was already doing research on Obama, I was the one who broke the story that Bill Ayers was responsible in part for the writing of Dream for My Father, which no one on the left, no one in the mainstream wanted to hear about. No one on the upper levels of the conservative media wanted to hear about either, which was shocking and unfortunate. But eventually they relented and we kind of accept that. But when it came down to the poem that Obama wrote as a college student called Pop, I said this isn't about his grandfather. This is about Frank Marshall Davis. It's transparent, just based on the clues in the poem. And the old poet, blah, 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 whose mother died when he was a boy. No, he's talking about that's Davis's biography. This is Davis. He's perfectly describing Davis. And yet I went into, you go into the major publications in New York or whatnot, New York Times. This is a loving poem about his grandfather. No, his grandfather is called Gramps. If he was going to write a poem, I didn't call it Gramps. Obama called Frank Marshall Davis Pop. That was his name. And that, you know, he's an older guy in that old sort of Hawaiian hippie neighborhood. It's clearly about him. And that's sexual overtones. And this becomes an issue. One thing that is in my new book, Barack Obama's Promised Land, is a letter that Obama wrote to an ex-girlfriend when he was in his early 20s, in which he says, and you know, we have the letter. It's not like I'm making this up. He goes, I make love to men daily, if only in my mind, right? And then he says, that's a quote. Now I'm paraphrasing. He goes, I see myself as androgynous and I'm becoming more androgynous by the day. How many 20-year-olds, 23-year-olds say this? I make love to men daily in my mind. This is before it was even fashionable, you know? I think he's bisexual. I think the evidence strongly suggests that. When Larry Sinclair did his press conference in 2008 at the National Press Club, coming out saying that he had a two-day coke and sex, party with Barack Obama, the media, of course, dismissed him immediately, attacked him, but what's the difference between him and Stormy Davis, right? Or him and Christine Blasey Ford? Sinclair hired his own room at the National Press Club, and he was very specific about the details of Obama, his relationship with Obama. And, of course, at the time, if you even mentioned his name or repeated his charges, you were a racist. He got that. And that was the one thing that Obama mastered, was stifling all dissent by calling people racist. And now, you know, you're racist, you know, when you wake up in the morning, you know. And if you're lucky, you're not a white supremacist before you go to bed at night. I mean, the charges have been so trivialized that it doesn't mean they don't hurt when they come your way.
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of conjecture about that from all sort of different sources. I remember back then of his homosexual dalliances in Hawaii, the cocaine use, being a bathhouse Barry with Rahm Emanuel there in Chicago.
And then there was the death of the choir director in Chicago. And I talk about that in the book. You can't overlook that. Unsolved murder, you know. And Sinclair, Larry Sinclair, at his press conference said that this guy, Donald, I forget his last name now, but the choir director, the gay choir director, was murdered in Chicago in December, I believe it was December 2007. Had been calling Sinclair and threatening him because he thought that he was moving in on Barack Obama. You know, Sinclair is an interesting character. He's a little nuts, but he'd have to be to do what he did to go public as he did, you know.
Yeah, I mean, we can't talk about this without talking the elephant in the room, I guess, if you will. There's also the conjecture that his wife is indeed not his wife.
I wouldn't go that far. I know there is that, you know, one of Joan Rivers' last words was to call Michelle a tranny.
Yeah.
And then she was dead, you know. No, I think Michelle Obama is totally female, you know.
Yeah. All right.
I can't go there.
I had to throw it out there just because we were on the topic.
I tell you what, I get asked that question more than any other question about Obama. Yeah. And, you know, and what I do in my books, and this is, you know, essentially why I keep getting new contracts, is that I stick to what I know.
Yeah.
And what I can prove. And if I move beyond what I can prove, I acknowledge that I'm speculating, you know. So I would not say for sure that Barack Obama was conceived on the mainland, but I would say that that's where all the evidence points. I mean, if you line up all the evidence, it makes sense of all the other variables. It makes sense of why she dropped out of the University of Hawaii in the second semester, why she was able to take what would have been a newborn baby on an airplane flight by herself to Seattle. But if the baby were 5 or 6 months old, he wouldn't have been newborn. Just as it would have made sense out of all the timing and the fact that all they would need to have done is to call in a home birth and pass it off as get him a birth certificate and call it a day. But if that birth certificate said, you know, it could have said Barack Obama, Barack Obama senior father, everything thinking right. But if the birthday were February 1961, then everything's screwed. The whole story is screwed. So what you do is I try to follow all the evidence to the most natural consequence, you know, and if I can't close it perfectly, I can give a degree of confidence to my speculation. And here I say it's about 80-90%.
Yeah, well, I mean, the actual facts are so damning. I mean, you don't really have to make much up or even give much conjecture because the Frank Marshall Davis stuff is prima facie.
Yeah.
And what you mentioned a moment ago, one of his other mentors, Bill Ayers, and his wife, Bernadine Dorm from the Weather Underground. I mean, these are just card-carrying communists. This is prairie fire. This is obvious stuff here.
Sure. One thing I talk about in my new book, Barack Obama's Promised Land, is the fact that we now know, you know, Obama said famously at the 2008 debate that ABC moderated with George Stephanopoulos, and Stephanopoulos caught a ton of heat for asking about Bill Ayers from the other media. And Obama famously said, oh, you know, he's like some guy in a neighborhood or whatever. But in fact, as David Garrow, this left-leaning civil rights Pulitzer Prize-winning historian, revealed, and he did all the grunt work, he got in on the ground floor, he said that Obama and Michelle were having almost nightly dinners with Bernadine Dorn and Bill Ayers during those Hyde Park years. Joining them was PLO zealot and supporter Rashid Khalidi, who was a friend of their, you know, mutual friend, and who Bill Ayers helped with his book, too. And Khalidi gives Ayers credit, unlike Obama. Obama is a politician. He couldn't give Ayers credit. He knew enough not to do that. So they were buds, you know. 2003, and this is the way the media work. I'm not telling you something you don't know. In 2003, Khalidi leaves Chicago to take a job at Columbia University in New York. And they have a going away party for him, right? And all of his Palestinian buddies there, Bill Ayers is there, Bernadine Dorn's there, Obama's there, you know? And the Los Angeles Times gets a copy of the tape of the meeting. It was all taped. And we know some of the things that were said. You know, they quoted a couple of them that were kind of incendiary, right? About, you know, kill all the Jews, that sort of thing. But they would never let out the tape. They would never share the tape. And they made up some BS story as to why they couldn't reveal it, but they sat on it through the election. Just like this NPR photographer sat on the photo he took of him, of Obama with Farrakhan until 2017, right? You've seen that photo.
Yeah.
But, you know, we didn't see it from 2005 when it was taken until 2017 when it was published. They, you know, the media, obviously, they worked overtime to conceal everything they could about Barack Obama. And that's why, you know, when I approached his book, Barack Obama's Promised Land, I have it's virgin territory, John. I mean, when I read the reviews of Obama's memoir, Promised Land, it dawned on me that the people reviewing his book in places like New York Times, et cetera, had no idea what he had done during his 8 years, you know. They didn't know who he was. They didn't know whether he was saying was true or false. All they could judge it on is whether it sounded good and whether it fit their preconceptions of who Obama was. So it's a trip. And I've got to give him, you know, I have to thank them for leaving all this stuff on the table for people like myself and yourself, you know.
We definitely got to get back into some of this older stuff as well, but let's get into what's in this new book, at least a little bit of teasers for the folks, because a lot of this stuff you've covered in some of the previous books, I have a feeling there's some gems in this new one, though.
Yeah, what makes this new book worth reading is that we now have Obama's own take on his own presidency, and that is important. And in some ways, it's a more honest book than the ones that have preceded it. In other ways, it's less honest. And he covers up, and it's the things he doesn't talk about that drive you crazy, you know. I read the book, for instance, with a speech, the best speech Obama ever gave. Was it the Father's Day speech he gave at the Apostolic Church in Chicago in June of 2008? And he gives the kind of speech that, you know, that you would expect Alan Keyes to have given that year, or, you know, Sarah Palin. And he said, you know, the problem is, and we have to, if we're honest with ourselves, we have to admit that the problem is that too many black men are leaving their homes. Too many are acting like boys instead of men. It's a problem, you know, ripe in the African-American community. It's gotten twice, it's doubled in its, the numbers have doubled just in a generation. 2 out of every 3 boys are growing up fatherless. And then he goes through the results. 5 times more likely to commit crime, 20 times more likely to end up in prison, blah, blah, blah. He lays it all out. There it is, okay? So when I'm reading A Promised Land, the Barack Obama's memoir, I'm hoping he'll talk about this speech. He talks about a lot of his other speech. He doesn't talk about this speech at all. Nor does he talk about why he stopped giving that speech. And so what I do for the readers, I fill in between the lines of the things that they're not going to get in A Promised Land. 3 weeks after he gives that speech, Jesse Jackson, at that time still a force, goes into a studio, a Fox News studio. He's on a hot mic, like he didn't know, right? And he says this, and I'm gonna be as much of a coward as anyone else and just say the N-word, because I'm not going to spell it out. Nowadays, even if you're talking about the N-word, you can't say the N-word, you know. Now, Jesse Jackson, when he talks, he doesn't talk in asterisks. You know, he spells it out. Mm-hmm. And he says, Barack Obama, he talking down to those N-words, you know, selling all this faith and family stuff. And then he does this. He goes, I want to cut his nuts out, right? This is what he says, right? And you see it with this slicing motion.
Yeah.
You know, he's a rural guy. He probably done that to a hog or something, you know. And, I would have loved, I mean, when I'm reading the memoir, I'm thinking, tell us how you felt about that, Barack. Tell us why you stopped talking about fatherhood. Even though I'll give him credit. I think he's an excellent father. If I had to say something good about him, I'd say, I think he's been a good father to Molly and Sasha. And if all young black kids had grown up the way they did, not quite the way they did, but, you know, with two parents in the household to care about them, this would be a different country, you know? Mm-hmm. It would be a much safer, more harmonious country. But he didn't. So after Jesse Jackson does this, Obama shuts up. He never talks about this subject again. And in the book, and this is one of the voids in the book that I think why it's important for us to read, because their side doesn't even know it's not there. You know, they don't know what's not there when they read a book like this. They don't know what stories he's leaving on the table. I would say another fascinating part of this book, and it's sort of the climactic part of the book, because it ends with his memoir ends with the raid on Osama bin Laden, is how he orchestrated that to take out not only Osama bin Laden, but to take out Donald Trump at the same time. And it's like I compare it to the baptism scene in The Godfather, you know, mm-hmm. where Michael is with his new nephew renouncing Satan. Meanwhile, his henchmen are out killing people and doing things, you know. Everything we've been told about, not everything, virtually everything we were told about the Osama bin Laden raid is false. And I go into that in some detail. But what's interesting is that Obama was obsessed with Donald Trump. This is in 2011. You know, if you remember, Trump came out and was talking about the birth certificate. And the timing of this has been lost on a lot of people, but these things happen day. Obama dispatches Perkins Coie to Hawaii to get the birth certificate, right? Now, Perkins Coie is the same law firm that produced the Steele dossier. So it's not a stretch to think that a firm that could produce the Steele dossier could produce any kind of birth certificate they wanted to, right?
Yeah.
And no one's going to question either one of them. So they send their person out to Hawaii to get the Steele dossier. Meantime, Obama's comic, you know, gag writers are writing his speech that he's going to give at the National Correspondents Club dinner, where he's going to focus his energy on Donald Trump, who's in the audience, right? Meantime, while he's doing that, the planners are out planning the raid on the Osama bin Laden, which I'm convinced was timed to get the birth certificate out of the news, and which it did. So that after the raid on Osama bin Laden, you weren't even allowed to talk about the birth certificate. It just became totally taboo. You know, it became taboo the way they made it taboo to talk about the outcome of the 2020 election. You know, you were, you know, disgraced if you even bothered to raise the subject. There's a fourth part in that sequence. And the fourth part was the day after the Osama raid. And this, they had to worry about this. Eric Holder was called upon into the Congress. And then you had a Republican Congress to testify about Fast and Furious, the gun running, inexplicable gun running scheme that Obama authorized while he was president. They lied about this at every stage. And I go through the book how they managed to, they didn't pull it off because Eric Holder was the first cabinet member in U.S. history to suffer, what did they call it? What did they do to him? Not censor him, it was worse than censor him. I forget it, but he was called out in a way that no other cabinet member had been called out. He still served out his term. It wasn't like, you know,
yeah,
he could brush it off because the media wouldn't say anything. But they totally lied about Fast and Furious. In fact, if you use the phrase Fast and Furious around a Democrat, they'll think you're talking about the movie franchise.
Of course.
I mean, they don't even know about this stuff. They don't know about it. It's like, you know, actually, I should say that this is the ideal book to get for your Democratic friends. Because it's first of all, it's relatively short. It's a good summer read. I keep it fairly amusing as much as I can. But Barack Obama's promised land will tell them the things that Barack Obama's promised land does not tell them. It'll tell them what actually happened during the Obama presidency and in the years leading up to his presidency. It's like they were able to spin the fiction for 8-12 years. And I don't know how the historians are going to deal with it because they're lying to themselves as well. You know?
That's one thing you've talked about that I found so interesting is that the right and the left both have these huge blind spots, or albeit sacred cows that can never be touched. I don't know how you really want to word it, but I mean, for the vast majority of the people out there, they're just taking in the milquetoast pablum from the mainstream right. media, and they're, you know, their blind spot's about this big. I mean, it's huge. They're never going to realize the truth about whatever it is, right or left.
Right.
And I've said this many times, that the biggest problem is not the Communist Party or the Democrats. It's the right. It's the right that's like, hey, hello.
Our guys are not all of them, obviously. There's a lot of good guys and women. But the absence of courage on our side is just much too noticeable. And that's why Trump was such a welcome change, you know. And, you know, in fact, I wrote a column. I had written a book in 2015 called Scarlet Letters about the increasing intolerance of the cult of liberalism and how they were, you know, Scarlet Letters meaning R for racism, S for sexism, et cetera. And I wrote an article to support the book in 2015 in early June. And it started off, the first sentence is this: the Republican nominee for president will be that candidate who best learns there is no future in apologizing.
Exactly.
At that time, I did not know Trump was a candidate, you know. About 2 weeks later, he comes down the escalator at Trump Tower and changes history. And what attracted Republicans to Trump was less his policies, certainly in the beginning, than his bravado. He wasn't afraid to wade in and call out Barack Obama, you know. Or, you know, he didn't tiptoe around these subjects. It was so refreshing. You would think that more Republicans would imitate him. There are a few who do. And they immediately ascend in popular esteem. But the rest are, too many of them are content to just keep their mouth shut and hope that the stuff doesn't, you know, get out of hand. So we had to sit there yesterday, and today is the 26th, on the 25th, and celebrate George Floyd's life. I mean, is this crazy, you know? That whole trial is a sham. It's, you know, and race is the biggest of sacred cows. And as I explained in the book, and I think I've gotten some very good feedback from some high-level African-Americans on it, because I go into and I talk about how the great tragedy of Barack Obama's presidency was his failure to do what everyone wanted him to do, even on our side and their side, is to convince African Americans that this is their country and that they belong here and they have a future here and that there's justice. And no, instead, he let the Jesse Jackson Al Sharpens in his head. And he led us in the opposite direction. He racialized everything. He let the media racialize everything. And now we have a clown like Joe Biden in the presidency who thinks he's the new, you know, Mahatma Gandhi. You know, I mean, you know, they had George Floyd's family at the White House yesterday. You know, they have the flags flying, Black Lives Matter flags flying in our embassies. This is sick. I mean, it really is. And it could have all been avoided. Obama had this golden opportunity. And when the day he was inaugurated, racial edges had never been better. You know, like 80% of whites and 70% of blacks said their racial relations are good and getting better. Now those numbers are like barely in double digits, you know. And while those numbers went down, you know, the number that went up was homicides, which was the flip side of that. And that's all on Barack Obama's plate. He had the chance to reverse momentum, and he did reverse the momentum. He reversed the momentum of improving racial relations and declining homicides by deteriorating racial relations and accelerating homicides.
Yeah, that's a pretty good poignant point there for his legacy. I think that's exactly
right. Legacy is the word. And that's his legacy, you know. Disillusionment, deception, disappointment, death.
Well, I know we got to go in a moment, but this is one of those big questions that a lot of people are thinking. How much is Barack Obama running the current administration? Because I know during the Trump administration, there was rumblings of, well, Obama and Valerie Jarrett are, you know, a mile away from the White House, still kind of pulling strings. Because, I mean, one of the big shortcomings I had from the get-go with Trump is he should have cleared house of everybody. But yeah, he left so many of those holdovers in office, and there was so much conjecture that, oh, Obama's, you know, a mile down the road, and he's still running things vastly from the inside.
But you know what percent of the vote Donald Trump got in the District of Columbia in 2016?
I don't.
4%, right? If he cleaned house, he would have been the only guy left in Washington.
Yeah.
That's how deeply they're embedded in that, every one of those departments, you know. I think he was a little naive, a little hopeful, you know, too trusting in that regard. I think if he had a second term, he'd know better, but which is probably why they're not allowing him a second term. I don't think – you see, Obama, I believe, is a front man for other people.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even think he was running the White House during the years he was in the White House.
I don't either.
You know who made 72 official visits to the White House during the first 6 years of the Obama presidency? Rudy Giuliani made this claim, and the fact checkers were all over. How dare you say that this person had 72 official visits to the White House in the first 6 years of the Obama presidency? Because they couldn't believe it. And then they fact checked it. And it was true. Al Sharpton, right?
Hmm.
These are the people who are running Obama. The real truth of, and this is, I get into it, there's probably the core thesis of my book, is that, and as Obama's own memoir, new memoir shows, his great vulnerability was his fear of African Americans, his fear of authentic African Americans. He never was one. He grows up in the least black state of America, in a white household, with white grandparents, white mother, goes to a white prep school or non-black prep school, comes to the mainland, and, you know, his idea of what an African-American is, he's gotten from watching the Mod Squad. You know what I mean? Can you imagine how frightening that would be, you know, to be walking down the street, people looking at you like you're an African-American, and you have no idea how to behave, you know? And that fear, and there are other blacks, the ones especially the political opposition, seized on that from the beginning. And that's why I think Jackson and Sharpton scared him out of being the president we would have wanted him to be, and ended up becoming a stooge for those forces, just as Joe Biden is now. I think they're both stooges, you know, honestly. I'd like to say, you know, I'm told I could sell more books if I said, yeah, Barack Obama is really running the White House, except he's not.
Yeah, well, he definitely seemed pretty Trump obsessed there.
Wait till we get in a book. Oh my God, he's Trump obsessed. And in his own book, Promised Land, there's one woman, conservative woman, he's totally obsessed with. And it's just surprising because no one would have thought about it. Hmm. And that's Sarah Palin.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, Sarah Palin, you know? And when you're reading a book, you're saying, what is this about, you know? You would thought an editor would have said, hey, Brock, you're getting a little over the top here. He's getting a little sexist and condescending. No, just kept pounding, you know?
That's bizarre.
And what bothered him about Sarah Palin is that, like Jesse Jackson, she was an authentic American, a real American. No one ever questioned her birth certificate. Mm-hmm. No one ever questioned Jesse Jackson's birth certificate. That whole thing about his being a racist thing that questions birth certificate had nothing to do with race, had everything to do with his foreignness, you know? He's the guy who listed himself as having been born in Kenya on his public relations brochure for literary agency that, you know, with which he was working. He's the one who said, I was, you know, the product that was born in Kenya. He literally said that, you know? We have the hard proof of that. So strange duck. But thanks for having me on. This has been great. Wanted to do this again. We got to do a TW800 one as the anniversary date approaches. 25 years in July 17th. So that's one of the great untold stories.
Yeah, absolutely. We got to get that going next month sometime before or at least around the anniversary day. That'd be great.
Sure. That would be great. And I hope if you could send me a link to the show, great. I'll post it every place and we'll go from there.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Jack. And tell everybody before you go how they can get to your site, how they can follow what you're doing. I mean, you got articles, books, and so much more. So how can people support you?
Right. The easiest way to access me in my site is just cashill.com. I beat my relatives to that site about 20 years ago and they're still angry with me. And the book is Barack Obama's Promised Land. Deplorables Need Not Apply. You know, even though I hate to recommend people go to Amazon, Amazon is the way they keep score in the publishing industry today. So please go to Amazon and buy the book. That'd be great. You'll enjoy it. It's a fun book. You know, I hate to say it. I don't want to write books about the depressed people, especially in the summer. And there are more than a few laughs in the book because there's something deeply comical about his whole presidency. You know,
you can laugh or you can cry. So laugh is
right.
A better option.
You might as well laugh, you know, and that's at least we've survived 8 years of him. Let's see if we can survive a couple more years of Joe Biden and we'll be in business, you know.
All right. Well, folks, if you missed any of that, fear not. You can go to anomicage.com. I'll have all of Jack's links there as well as today's video and audio of the show. As always, say you can't do everything, but you can do something. So get out there and do it. Until next time, I'll be seeing you sooner than later in the Anomic Cage.
Thank you for listening to The Anomic Age, a John Age project. For past shows, further info, and to comment, go to AnomicAge.com. That's AnomicAge.com. Till next time, thank you for listening to The Anomic Age. I'm gonna go to the bathroom.